The Theater of the Mind.
Hello. My name is Dr. Mercurio Arborea, and I am the founder of the Arborea Institute. Through our unique blend of benign pharmacology, sensory therapy, and energy sculpting, we can guide you to a new, better, happier you. You are about to embark on a great journey. Let the new age of enlightenment begin.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order.
It's no longer a theory. What I'm about to say is fact. The secret organizations of the world power elite are no longer secret. They have planned and are now leading us into a one world communist government.
Welcome, useless eaters, to the Odd Man Out podcast, where we talk about hidden history, deep political policy, occult deconstruction, economics, religion, and philosophy. I'm your rabbit hole aficionado, the Odd Man. Welcome.
The affirmative task we have now is to create a new world order.
Public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
And when that first cocaine was smuggled in on a ship, it may as well have been a deadly bacteria so much as it hurt the body, the soul of our country. But take my word for it, this scourge will stop.
The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. This passage was written by Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and a pioneering mind behind advertising, modern propaganda, and the field of public relations. Bernays' influence was enormous. Relying heavily on the insights of his uncle, he developed highly successful manipulation techniques which are still used today, not only by companies to sell consumer products, but also by the powers that be to, in the words of Bernays, control and regiment the masses.
The Cambridge Dictionary says that the word propaganda means the following: information or ideas that are spread by an organized group or government to influence people's opinions, especially by not giving all the facts or by secretly emphasizing only one way of looking at the facts. The Sage Pub website under Propaganda Through the Ages says the use of propaganda has been an integral part of human history and can be traced to ancient Greece for its philosophical and theoretical origins. Used effectively by Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, and the early Christians, propaganda became an integral part of the religious conflicts of the Reformation. The invention of the printing press was quickly adopted by Martin Luther in his fight against the Catholic Church and provided the idea medium for widespread use of propagandistic materials. Each new medium of communications was quickly adopted for use by propagandists, especially during the American and French Revolutions, and later by Napoleon. By the end of the 19th century, improvements in the size and the speed of mass media had greatly increased the sophistication and effectiveness of propaganda.
I shall control your mind. You will have no personality of your own. You will answer only to me. When I've finished with you, you will be attached to a machine, which will draw its energy from your body. You will be a slave on the assembly line.
The basic problem is that we are living in a virtual reality. We're living in a totally controlled environment, an environment that has been created by mass media. Now, many people, especially young people, accept unquestioningly the reality that is presented by the media. Popular culture, movies, television, music, carry messages about how society works and how people should behave. And so entertainment is not value-free. It has ideological content. It presents a worldview that influences the people who watch the programming. There is a reason why television networks and the music industry, the various companies, they have programming departments. The programming that we are constantly assaulted by throughout our life conditions us, it programs us to a particular worldview. Now, we may consider it normal because we were born into this system of lies and deception. In fact, deception has become part of the social framework of society. And because we were born into this situation and our parents were born into it and have suffered from it, we don't know any better. And so we don't necessarily see things as they are, we see things as we are. Now, there are two primary means by which people are manipulated and controlled. One is very simple, very basic, and that is simply the control of information. If we don't have all of the facts on any particular topic, then our judgment is going to be no better than the quality of our information. And in spite of the fact that we have an information overload through all the information that's available on the internet and other sources, we have to have the presence of mind to be able to evaluate the information that we have available. And it's a matter of having to dig through and determine what's true, what are the lies, what are the half-truths, under that one basic heading, information control, where there has been a long-held consolidation of ownership of the different medias, press, publishing, film, music, television, consolidated ownership into the hands of very few individuals and the multinational corporations. Today, there are a half a dozen multinational corporations that are controlling the information and entertainment choices that people have.
It goes on to say that the use of deliberate forms of speech carefully calculated to deliver a persuasive message can also be found in the writings of Confucius in his Analects, where he suggests that the use of good rhetoric, together with the proper forms of speech and writing, could be used to persuade men to live meaningful lives. Bruce L. Smith pointed out in 1958 that his Platonic admonition was echoed in our modern world by the leaders of communist China. Only it was called brainwashing. Although many changes have taken place in China during the past 30 years, the Chinese government still creates and promotes the systematic and deliberate propaganda messages aimed at creating cohesive communist societies among the diverse populations.
Obama repealed the 1948 Smith-Mundt Act, which then permitted propaganda to be in broadcasting. It no longer said that it had to be credible.
It goes on to say that Julius Caesar was a master propagandist, equaled only by Napoleon and Hitler in his understanding of meaningful symbols and in his ability to understand instinctively the psychological needs of his audience. He understood the need to use such symbols of power and sophistication as a means of converting subject populations to the Roman way of life. This was far less expensive than maintaining elaborate garrisons of legionnaires and induced obedience to the new regime through cooperation and identification rather than subjugation. Significantly, subject peoples were often granted the right to become Roman citizens under certain circumstances, thus increasing personal identification with the conqueror. Now, certainly, propaganda has been around far longer than has been documented, probably since nearly the beginning of time, or at least the beginning of tribes and governing bodies. because it just comes natural to the leading rulers to use psychological propaganda, specialized rhetoric on their people for controlling them. Therefore, propaganda is not unique to any religion, to any culture, to any political system. Propaganda has been used by all cultures, nations, and societies throughout the ages. And today we're going to be getting into propaganda as a whole and looking at many of the men who have written about propaganda, psychological warfare, and the like in the modern age. Men like, of course, Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays, Aldous Huxley, George Orwell, Marshall McLuhan, Joost Mierlo, Harold Laswell, even Jim Keith, and more modern writers. I'm kind of putting together a couple of shows from all my years now of looking into this stuff, because I think that we need this now more than ever. We need to understand how we're controlled, how our strings are pulled. And I know that most of the people listening to this will probably already be aware of a lot of these techniques, but at the same time, I think that you will benefit from this, and also I hope that you will share with other people who may be on the fence about these kinds of things, who may be just now kind of waking up to find out that their world was not quite what we were told it was when we were young. Now, there's three types of propaganda. White propaganda, which is overt, where sponsorship is acknowledged directly and which is considered to be truthful. Black propaganda, which refers to untruthful activities where the origin of the activities is falsified or the activities are covert. Then, lastly, there is gray propaganda, situated between white and black propaganda, where there is no clear indication of origin or the origin is attributed to an ally where the truth of the information is uncertain.
100 years ago, a new theory about human nature was put forward by Sigmund Freud. He had discovered, he said, primitive sexual and aggressive forces hidden deep inside the minds of all human beings. Forces which, if not controlled, led individuals and societies to chaos and destruction. Those in power have used Freud's theories to try and control the dangerous crowd in an age of mass democracy. At the heart of the story is not just Sigmund Freud, but other members of the Freud family. Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today, but his influence on the 20th century was nearly as great as his uncle's. Because Bernays was the first person to take Freud's ideas about human beings and use them to manipulate the masses. He showed American corporations for the first time how they could make people want things they didn't need by linking mass-produced goods to their unconscious desires. Out of this would come a new political idea of how to control the masses. By satisfying people's inner selfish desires, one made them happy and thus docile. It was the start of the all-consuming self, which has come to dominate our world today.
Now we're going to talk about Walter Lippmann a little bit on the show. He was kind of the predecessor to Bernays. He wrote books on public communication, group communication. I think one was called The Phantom Public. One was called Public Opinion. He was an early Council on Foreign Relations member. He was also an American Fabian who worked alongside John Dewey, the father of progressive education. So this is a very important guy. And I found an interesting article here, ncbi.nlmnhi.gov, The Fabians Come to America. In 1895, the Fabian Society of England came to the United States and helped establish an American Society of Intellectuals. Some of America's most influential writers, playwrights, authors, poets, industrialists, labor leaders, and politicians flocked to the new society. Dignitaries such as Jack London, Upton Sinclair, Felix Frankfurter, Walter Lippmann, and Louis Brandeis were members and dedicated followers of this collectivist idea. Most were quite open in their writings as to their dedication to collectivism. The new society in 1905 changed its name to the Intercollegiate Socialist Society. By 1921, because of the unpopularity of the name socialist, they once again changed their name as the League for Industrial Democracy. The first issue of their official magazine, the American Fabian, printed by the Budding Society in February 1895, outlined its objectives in America. On the top of their list was to effect a series of basic changes in the Constitution itself that would make possible the introduction of state socialism step by step in the United States. In the same issue, they observed that England's unwritten constitution readily allows changes so that England can move into socialism almost imperceptibly. But our constitution, being largely individualistic, must be changed to admit socialism, and each change necessitates a political crisis. The real or manufactured crisis is always the engine of revolutionary assaults on traditional political structures. Never let a crisis go to waste. Hegelian dialectic, problem, reaction, solution. Even a brief review of American history, since the time these words were printed, will attest to the brilliance of this plan. Collectivism has made tremendous strides as a result of a series of contrived as well as real crises. World War I, the stock market crash of 1929, and the subsequent Great Depression of the 1930s, World War II, and so on. Today, as an example, we are told of a persistent crisis in healthcare delivery that acts as a political impetus for the establishment of a universal healthcare coverage, in effect a socialist national healthcare plan. 3 years after the new party was established, British Fabian socialist Ramsay MacDonald, on a return visit to the United States, said, "The great bar to socialist progress in the United States is the written constitution, federal and state, which gives ultimate power to a law court." As we shall see, much attention has been given to correcting this problem. This is interesting. We're going to play a couple of clips here. One is Lord Bertrand Russell, and he was a Fabian socialist. He was a professor at the London School of Economics and Social Sciences that the Fabians started, and he says the goal, you know, really is world socialism, world government. And then we'll play a short clip from Zbigniew Brzezinski, who says that wars lead to socialism. And I think that that's really what they want, is a world government. It's the same old story, even if it sounds cliche. They want a world socialist government. Obviously, it wouldn't be pure socialism or pure communism, but a concoction of a bunch of different isms. Now let's listen closely to these two very, very influential elites.
And I think three things are necessary if people are to live happily in the industrial phase. One of these is world government. The second is an approximate economic equality between different parts of the world. And the third is a nearly stationary population.
First World War ended up in 200 million people going to socialism. World War II ended in 900 million people going to socialism. World War III will end up with all of mankind not turning to ashes, but turning to socialism.
That's the most optimistic point of view.
Wow, that's very optimistic.
As we continue this article, judicial activism, socialism with teeth. It was Felix Frankfurter who advocated the concept of judicial activism before his elevation to the Supreme Court. Felix Frankfurter, those we don't speak of. This idea transformed the intended purpose of the court from interpretation of the law to creation of new laws through leftist interpretation. This, of course, was one of the early goals of the Fabians, to break down the separation of powers. Judicial activism gives the courts the traditional judicial power as well as the new power to legislate, all the while separated from the voter. This new judicial power did not go unrecognized. In his 1967 Carpentier lecture at Columbia University, Justice Adolph A. Burrell opened by saying, "The thesis can be briefly stated. Ultimate legislative power in the United States has come to rest in the Supreme Court of the United States. This is a revolution. The unique fact is that the Revolutionary Committee is the Supreme Court of the United States." This reminds me of Thomas Jefferson, who was adamantly against the Supreme Court, and he said we were basically making rulers out of this small group of people. And we go on here. One of President Woodrow Wilson's closest friends was the Harvard Law professor and later Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis, those we don't speak of. Brandeis, a supporter of the idea of a sociological interpretation of the Constitution, was the justice who, interestingly, solved the Fabians' biggest dilemma, how to fund their massive new collectivist social programs. In a conversation with Associate Justice Benjamin Cardozo on how to fund social insurance, he whispered, "The taxing power of the federal government, my dear, the taxing power is sufficient for everything you want and need, and the rest is history." And as you guys may have guessed, this Benjamin Cardozo, who we just quoted, also a member of those we don't speak of. Let's go on here. President Wilson's closest advisor, Colonel Edward Mandel House, was a Fabian Society member, and it was Colonel House's opinion that the United States Constitution, a creation of 18th century minds, was not only outmoded, but grotesque, and ought to be scrapped or rewritten. The British socialist, Harold Laski, those we don't speak of, tells us why they feared the Constitution when he stated, "It was capitalism's strongest safeguard on earth today." He also called for all liberal, socialist, and communist groups to advance the idea of a democratic socialism. You know, as much as we try to get away from the those we don't speak of subject, there's just no way, because they've had such an important role in history, covertly. Not many people have put this together, and not many people have the balls to do it. But you have to understand, if you've listened to the Those We Don't Speak Of series, that we know Frankfurter and Brandeis were in a secret society called the Parashim, which means Pharisees, and it was out of Harvard, I believe, either Yale or Harvard, from the Menorah Club or Menorah Society. And they were working all along for Zionist purposes, even when they were Supreme Court justices. And Brandeis went on to be a big-time Zionist leader. So these guys, they were not America first, that's for sure. And I think there's a lot of people in these presidential administrations and probably in the Supreme Court now that are certainly not America first. And we'll go on a little bit farther here. In 1920, the Fabians formed the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, primarily to combat arrest and deportation of communists, and also to promote leftist judicial activism. One of its founders was Supreme Court Justice and Fabian socialist Felix Frankfurter. I wrote an article for the Greensboro News on the history of the ACLU, including its early domination by communist board members. The newspaper would not print the article until it had been approved by the national headquarters of the ACLU. But it was approved. Philip Kurland, in an article for Modern Age, summarized the basic problem of judicial activism when he said, "Essentially, the problem is that we have become a society overburdened by laws, whether they be statutes or executive orders or regulations or guidelines or judicial decrees. It has been observed that today most laws are not made by the legislature, but rather by bureaucrats. Hundreds of thousands of pages of laws are written every day by an army of unaccountable bureaucrats who are, in essence, destroying freedom." And so I just wanted to add this part because it talked about Walter Lippmann briefly and how all this is connected. A lot of this stuff in history and these different groups, the Zionists, the Fabians, the CFR members and the Rhodes Roundtable groups, Bernays, all these people are connected, and they had similar goals. And so I think it's important to get all this out. We're going to revisit this article on the Fabian Society history, part 3, and we'll go back into this and finish this up because there's a lot of great information in here. And you see Brandeis come back up. You see Frankfurter come back up. So, you know, this could easily be a part on one of the Those We Don't Speak Of episodes, but I think we'll actually put this in the Fabian Society because it's more related to them. Now we'll get into Walter Lippmann a little bit deeper, and it mentions him here in another clip from the Century of Self documentary series, which again, I highly recommend.
Forces that could erupt easily to produce the frenzied mob, which had the power to destroy even governments. It was this they believed had happened in Russia. To many, this meant that one of the guiding principles of mass democracy was wrong. The belief that human beings could be trusted to make decisions on a rational basis. The leading political writer, Walter Lippmann, argued that if human beings were in reality driven by unconscious, irrational forces, then it was necessary to rethink democracy. What was needed was a new elite who could manage what he called the bewildered herd. This would be done through psychological techniques that would control the unconscious feelings of the masses.
So here you have Walter Lippmann, probably the most influential political thinker in the United States, who is essentially saying that the basic mechanism of the mass mind is unreason, is irrationality, is animality. He believes that the mob in the street, which is how he sees ordinary people, are people who are driven not by their minds but by their spinal cords. The notion of kind of animal drives, unconscious instinctual drives lurking beneath the surface of civilization. And so they started looking towards psychological science as a way of understanding the mechanisms by which the popular mind works, specifically with the goal of figuring out how to understand how to apply those mechanisms to strategies for social control.
In Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, which came out in 1922, so that's 6 years before Bernays' propaganda, he said that within the life of a generation now, in control of affairs, persuasion has become a self-conscious art and a regular organ of popular government. None of us begins to understand the consequences, but it is no daring prophecy to say that the knowledge of how to create consent will alter every political calculation and modify every political premise. Under the impact of propaganda, not necessarily in the sinister meaning of the word alone, the old constants of our thinking have become variables. It is no longer possible, for example, to believe in the original dogma of democracy, that the knowledge needed for the management of human affairs comes up spontaneously from the human heart. Where we act on that theory, we expose ourselves to self-deception and to forms of persuasion that we cannot verify. It has been demonstrated that we cannot rely upon intuition, conscience, or the accidents of casual opinion if we are able to deal with the world beyond our reach. And then in his book in 1956, The Public Philosophy, he had time to kind of gather all of his writings and look at what had happened to the country, look at Bernays' work and see what had come true and all of these different things. And this is what he said. When the world wars came, the people of the liberal democracies could not be aroused to the exertions and the sacrifices of the struggle until they had been frightened by the opening disasters, had been incited to passionate hatred, and had become intoxicated with unlimited hope. To overcome this inertia, the enemy had to be portrayed as evil incarnate, as absolute and congenital wickedness. The people wanted to be told that when this enemy had been forced to unconditional surrender, they would re-enter the Golden Age. This unique war would end all wars. This last war would make the world safe for democracy. This crusade would make the whole world a democracy. We know that that's been one of the motives, is to create this world government, and they have this kind of fantastical idea of democracy, which again is mob rules, if it's a real democracy that's not plagued by propaganda, mass propaganda. And don't get me wrong, a representative republic has its own setbacks as well, but we all know how crazy the crowd can be, and usually is at some point or another, and it doesn't take much to get them going. He goes on to say in the same book, "There's no mystery about why there is such a tendency for popular opinion to be wrong, and judging more in peace. Usually, moreover, when the decision is critical and urgent, the public will not be told the whole truth. What can be told to the great public, it will not hear in the complicated and qualified concreteness that is needed for a practical decision. When distant and unfamiliar and complex things are communicated to great masses of people, the truth suffers a considerable and often a radical distortion. The complex is made over into the simple, the hypothetical into the dogmatic, and the relative into the absolute. Even when there is no deliberate distortion by censorship and propaganda, which is unlikely in a time of war, the public opinion of the masses cannot be counted upon to apprehend regularly and properly the reality of things." Aldous Huxley said in Brave New World Revisited, "In regard to propaganda, the early advocates of universal literacy and a free press envisaged only two possibilities. The propaganda might be true, or the propaganda might be false. They did not foresee what in fact has happened, above all in our Western capitalist democracies, the development of a mass communications industry, concerned in the main neither with the true nor the false, but with the unreal, the more or less totally irrelevant. In a word, they failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions." And Winston Churchill was credited with saying, "Never have so many been manipulated by so few." George Orwell said that unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept dark, without the need for any official ban. Anyone who has lived long in a foreign country will know of the instances of sensational items of news, things which on their own merits would get the big headlines, being kept right out of the British press. Not because the government intervened, but because of a general tacit agreement that it wouldn't do to mention that particular fact. So far as the daily newspapers go, this is easy to understand. The British press is extremely centralized, and most of it is owned by wealthy men who have every motive to be dishonest on certain important topics. But the same kind of veiled censorship also operates in books and periodicals, as well as in plays, films, and radio. And that was from Animal Farm. And Jacques Ellul, who wrote the great book Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes, The Technological Society, Anarchy and Christianity, goes on and on. He said that propaganda tries, first of all, to create conditioned reflexes in the individual so that certain words, signs, or symbols, even certain persons or facts, provoke unfailing reactions. The important thing is that when the time is ripe, the individual can be thrown into action by the utilization of the psychological levers that have been set up. And he could not have been more correct. I mean, when you look at the way people are triggered nowadays, especially with the two-party system that we have in place, and just the way mass propaganda works in America. I was thinking, too, when we were talking about how the press can be controlled and how Orwell was saying, you know, sometimes it's what they don't report on. And I couldn't help but think of a piece Redacted played where they explained that CNN has to get permission to report stories on Israel. And then just a few days later, it came out that the New York Times has been told basically that they cannot say certain words like genocide, occupation, and things like that related to the overtaking of Palestine. So in the liberals' mind, we've talked about this before, in the liberals' mind, they're told, just average liberal people, constantly, and this is constantly reinforced, that the right-leaning people, the conservatives, are anti-Semites. And then on the other side, constantly reinforced, the conservative pundits are telling their people that the liberals are anti-Israel. And it really just keeps people fighting and fighting, but relatively they want generally the same things. And it's interesting too, because as we've talked about so many times, all the presidential administrations are just filled with Zionists, whether it's a Democrat or Republican administration.
Working as an editor, it was easy to see how simple it is to change the meaning of an event or change the meaning of what someone says through editing. And so I was very well aware of how plastic and moldable media reality was. But I didn't fully appreciate the extent to which we are all manipulated and controlled by media, including those people who work in it. Using television as the prime example of how mental programming and mind control works, television is the most powerful weapon of psychological warfare in history. And yet, television, for many people, is a member of the family in the household.
It's the primary member.
Yes.
It runs the household.
Yes, well, not only that, but it's the primary source of information, and the television, in effect, represents an altar, a religious altar that the nation is worshiping before. Many people don't think about the things that affect them subconsciously, because generally they don't know what to look for until someone comes around and starts pointing these things out to them, and then they can see how we are all influenced by unseen forces without our conscious awareness. In fact, the ultimate control is to control people without their conscious awareness. Again, television is a prime example. Think back to whenever you have observed young children or older adults sitting watching television. They have this glassy-eyed, vacant look in their eyes because they are in a trance state, in a hypnotic state of mind. This is very important, very significant, that the medium of television has the capacity to do this, and it doesn't matter what you're watching. The flickering effect of the television image, although it appears to be static and stationary, it is actually flickering. We don't see it consciously, but subconsciously, the repeating visual pattern of the flicker induces the trance state. And that's the basic principle behind hypnotic programming, is that you get the subject to focus the attention of the conscious mind on one of the five senses. So in the case of watching television, we're talking about the sense of sight and the flickering image. In the case of sound, any repeating sound pattern will induce the trance state. Now, why this is important is that we are more suggestible to mental programming during this state of mind than at any other time. We're very vulnerable to manipulation at this time, because the first order of business for a propagandist or an advertiser is to create the circumstances that will induce a state of mind that is favorable to the reception of their message. And that state of mind is the hypnotic state of mind, making television extremely important in this whole process of creating a unified mindset among the entire population.
In relation to what we were just talking about, Wilson Brian Key, in the book The Age of Manipulation, The Con in Confidence, The Sin in Sincere, he says that public relations manipulation, much of which is presented as news information, can be true in a simplistic, linear sense, even provable in court. But on the other hand, such statements can also be false when considered in context or in relation to other concealed information. Ad copy is often a technical masterpiece of deception that can be true at one level, but upon closer examination, also false. A maze of federal agencies supposedly regulates ads for false and deceptive statements. The Federal Trade Commission is the most important, with a large staff of attorneys who act against only the most blatant offenders. Among ad copywriters, FTC regulations are considered a joke. Any experienced writer can verbalize around any law that could be written simply through a knowledge of Aristotelian logic. And as we're going to be talking a lot about Bernays, in regards to media, he said way back in 1928 that the American motion picture is the greatest unconscious carrier of propaganda in the world today. It is a great distributor for ideas and opinions. The motion picture can standardize the ideas and habits of a nation. Because pictures are made to meet market demands, they reflect, emphasize, and even exaggerate broad popular tendencies rather than stimulate new ideas and opinions. The motion picture avails itself only of ideas and facts which are in vogue. As the newspaper seeks to purvey news, it seeks to purvey entertainment. And I've talked about in the past how so many things that we like, we probably wouldn't even like them if they hadn't been so heavily marketed to us. And say, let's take, and you can tell my age by saying this, let's take the grunge era, the grunge music era in the early 90s. Now, that was a small scene in Seattle. And of course, the music industry wanted to mass market it like they do every movement, every new movement. Like when Guns N' Roses came out, they were kind of a heavier, not glam, they were kind of a, some called them sleaze metal or whatever, sleaze rock. But here you got like 40 bands trying to copy Guns N' Roses. And a lot of those bands just sucked. And that's the way these big advertising agencies and the big industries jump on things and destroy authentic movements. You know, MTV was the biggest pusher of Nirvana, and they wouldn't have been nearly as big if MTV hadn't been so influential at the time. Now, don't get me wrong, I think Nirvana had some great songs, but, you know, they only had really two good albums, Bleach and Nevermind, and then In Utero had a couple of good songs on it. And, of course, they had the Unplugged album, too. And who knows what they would have went on to do, but they were constantly pushed by MTV. But MTV, they almost killed the grunge era, the grunge movement, as fast as it was created, because they changed, completely kind of turned their back on that type of music quite quickly, and only a handful of bands actually survived. But it all comes down to the love of money. They want to make more and more money. They don't care about the art. And it seems like that's the way a lot of industries are that are art-related. Everything gets watered down and mass-produced till it doesn't mean anything anymore. And that's why I think there's a lot of great underground bands, bands that never got signed to a big label. You have to look a little harder for them, but there's some great bands out there that write great music. And, well, and there's great podcasts as well out there that don't get much attention that do really deep dives. I digress.
Edward Bernays was fascinated by Lippmann's arguments and also saw a way to promote himself by using them. In the 1920s, he began to write a series of books which argued that he had developed the very techniques Lippmann was calling for. By stimulating people's inner desires and then sating them with consumer products, he was creating a new way to manage the irrational force of the masses. He called it the engineering of consent.
Democracy, to my father, was a wonderful concept, but I don't think he felt that all those publics out there would had reliable judgment, and that they could that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above. It's enlightened despotism in a sense. You appeal to their desires and their unrecognized longings, that sort of thing. That you can tap into their deepest desires or their deepest fears and use that to your own purposes.
All right, guys, before we get out of here, I want to quote Vance Packard from The Hidden Persuaders, and then we'll close out with another couple of quotes by Walter Lippmann, since this episode is really focused on Lippmann more than Bernays or even Freud, and we will get to those two later on in this series. But Vance Packard said this about the public relations craze. The files on the public relations journal contain what to an outsider may seem like a startling number of accounts of American men of science cooperating intimately and confidentially with the mind molders and would-be molders of public relations. To cite a few examples, in June 1953, the journal described under the title Orientation in the Social Sciences, a series of seminars held at Columbia University Teachers College for New York members of the Public Relations Society of America. Six doctors in the social sciences, headed up by Lyman Bryson, social anthropologist, did the orienting. All were Columbia men. Dr. Bryson told the publicists, "If you are engineering consent, then I think the social sciences would like to warn you that you should begin with a basic analysis of three levels upon which consent moves in a society like ours. The first level," he said, "is human nature." He added that little could be done here to manipulate the people. The second level was cultural change, cultural Marxism, if you will, which he said is where you must operate if you want to influence people's ideas. The third level is the region of choice. Here is where an impulse is running in a particular direction, and some sort of choice will be made regardless, as when a choice between similar products is made. At this level, he said, it is relatively easy to manipulate people. On the other hand, if you are trying to change their ideas, you work on the second level, where different psychological pressures, techniques, and devices from those successful on the third level must be used. And we've talked about Columbia. It's just a hub for elites in mind control matters. It's kind of interesting that Columbia is the goddess and Washington, D.C. is named after Columbia and her statue sits on top of the U.S. Capitol. And I believe Nancy Pelosi called the Capitol a temple. We know that Columbia is tied to John Dewey and also to the Frankfurt School. And you could get really deep into that if you wanted. But for reasons of time, we're going to move on and we'll probably hit that at another point in the series. But to finish up this episode, I want to read one more quote from Walter Lippmann from his public policy book of 1956, because I think it's telling on how the elites feel about average people. And though I complain now about average people myself, I do believe that if the people were given better information, obviously there would be a lot more informed people making better decisions. But the elites don't see it that way. This is what Lippmann said, and remember, this is years and years later after he'd been studying how to manipulate masses. "The mass of absolutely illiterate, of feeble-minded, grossly neurotic, undernourished, and frustrated individuals is very considerable, much more considerable than we generally suppose. Thus, a wide popular appeal is circulated among persons who are mentally children or barbarians, people whose lives are a morass of entanglements, people whose vitality is exhausted, shut-in people, and people whose experience has comprehended no factor in the problem under discussion." There he's just basically talking about why the public needs to be manipulated through mass communications and mass media, because the public is not intelligent enough to make the right decisions. And he basically gives it away there in that little book that democracy, the democracy we actually have, is not real democracy. It is a public who thinks they live in a democracy, but their minds are conditioned, nudged, and controlled by the government, their public relations guys, social scientists, and the like. And the news media are accomplices to that. And I'd say that much of conservative talk radio and content are also accomplices to that. They're just kind of the other side of the coin. You kind of need both sides to keep people fighting and divided and confused and to keep them distracted. And think about how Lippmann saw the public. Those words that he said in that excerpt. It really reminds me of some of the things that famous eugenicist Margaret Sanger said about the people that she didn't believe deserved to live. It also reminds me of what the Freemasons call the profane masses. And in one of our episodes on Those We Don't Speak Of, we learned that the Kabbalists say initially the same thing about the non-capitalists. So I just thought that was worth bringing up. And as we come to a close, I just want you to understand how important it is to know the levels of manipulation that the public has been receiving for decades upon decades. Again, you go back to Bernays' propaganda book, which was in 1928. His Crystallizing Public Opinion book was before that in 1923. And the year before that, Lippmann wrote Public Opinion. Lippmann also wrote The Phantom Public. I forget which year, but around that time. So these guys were already schooled in how to manipulate the minds of the masses. And in the next episode, we're going to, of course, look further into Bernays. We're also going to look into some of the works that predated Bernays and Lippmann. And that was Gustave Le Bon. And he talked about the crowd and how the crowd was so easily moved and manipulated through propaganda, through specialized words and different things like that. And I believe Charles McKay wrote his book on crowds even before Le Bon. I think Le Bon wrote his maybe in the late 1880s. And I believe Charles McKay and his book on crowds was in the 1840s. So this stuff's been going on for a very long time. It's just been different levels of study about how to exactly propagandize, mold, nudge, condition the minds of the masses. And I think I've made it a main theme in my show from the beginning how important it is to recognize propaganda techniques, to realize that you're being nudged, pushed, and conditioned in certain ways. They want you to react in certain ways. And I know I've said this before, but we have a record online now. Everything we say and do, everything we like, every statement, every video that we play, every quote that we paste on, you know, to social media, it's being tracked. It's going into databases. This information is being kept and sold. You get into the Five Eyes program. Biden just passed another FISA bill that gives the NSA even more power. Trump gave them even more power. So it's just an ongoing thing. The government's getting more powerful. We're getting closer to a GovCorp, you know, the public-private partnerships, which we think is the end goal. One giant public-private partnership. But I think that hopefully this series will kind of bring a lot of this stuff that we've talked about really from the beginning of the Oddcast, bring it together and help you guys to kind of understand this stuff a little bit better and perhaps give you something to share with some friends and family who you think could benefit from understanding this kind of information, because it's really not talked about very much in the norm. You know, it's who wants to sit and talk about propaganda techniques during a movie, you know, or a sporting event? I mean, not many people, but people like us, we do, because we recognize this stuff when we see it out in the mainstream. So thank you so much once again for hanging out with me. And I hope that this has been a blessing to you that you will share with others. I want to quickly thank my patrons. I want to thank Anne. I want to thank Anthony. I want to thank Cole. I want to thank Ashley. I want to thank that crazy bread man for being a covert co-conspirator. I want to thank Aaron. I want to thank Ruckus for being a producer of the show. Check out Ruckus's content on The Daily Ruckus on alternatecurrentradio.com and on TNT Radio as well. Ruckus is a producer over there, and you can hear him on various segments. And congratulations to him, because he just became the producer of The Jason Burma Show. So thank you, Ruckus, for your support. Thank you to No Evil Shall I Fear. Thank you to James. Thank you to Bill for being a producer of the show. Thank you to The Mighty Kilowatt. And thank you to Sir Tim of the Tunnels. You guys mean a lot. And I, as always, it seems like I'm always apologizing for taking a long time, but I've been out of town. I've been sick, as you can probably tell in this episode. I'm very hoarse. I've lost my voice numerous times, but I wanted to get this out to you guys, and I want to continue this series like I have the Those We Don't Speak Of series, which connects, as we talked about earlier in the show, but I think this is another one that we can kind of spread out, because there's really a lot of content out there, a lot of studies on the public mind, and we probably won't do more than 5 shows on it, but I think it's important, again, to get this information out, help people to understand it, and hopefully give them the tools to recognize this stuff in the public. And I know a lot of you guys already recognize a lot of it, but I think that just looking back at these historical quotes and this historical information will solidify the fact that this is going on as we possibly lead up to World War III. And I hope, of course, that we're not, but I see the propaganda ramping up big time on social media. I think that there's so much out there that's just outright lies that is trying to push us towards being okay with probably going to war with Iran, possibly Russia, or at least wanting us to be okay with the threat of it, if you know what I mean. Because there's a lot of things that GovCorp can get done even under the threat of war, because it causes a lot of fear, a lot of chaos, division, and distraction. But with that being said, guys, I want to thank AlternateCurrentRadio.com for hosting my show. Get on over there and check out all their fine podcasts. They've got music and talk shows. Check out their flagship, The Boiler Room. Also, thank you to FrenchRadioNetwork.com for carrying the show as well. Cheers and blessings, guys. And remember, their order is not our order. See ya.